Hey Fresh Capital listeners, big news came out over the last week that Bob Iger, famous ex-CEO of Disney, is coming back and kicking out his hand-picked successor, Bob Chapek, from the business. With over 200 million subscribers across its content streaming platforms and some of the most iconic movies and TV IP in the game, what's happening at Disney will affect how content is made and consumed around the world. We break down the recent news and deep dive into the Disney media and entertainment business in this week's episode. Keep listening and enjoy. Welcome to another episode of Fresh Capital. Every week we provide a refreshingly simple way to learn about companies and investing. My name is Dan. Joining me, as always, Albert. How are you doing?
Dan, I'm good. This is our first Saturday morning recording session in a while.
Didn't stop you going out last night, I take it?
No, well, I mean, we were talking about this offline, but I'm feeling a bit worse for wear this morning. But is what it is for a Saturday.
It is, but I don't think it'll affect you. I mean, you're a big fan of Disney, the company we'll be covering today, and a big fan of what's been going on recently. So if we start off at the top, Albert, because I think lots of people have got a pretty general understanding, good understanding of what is Disney, but they might not have heard the latest news that dropped this week, which is pretty transformational for the company. Do you want to get into the swap switch of CEOs at Disney?
For sure. So the current CEO now, Bob Iger, has just kind of stepped back into the role after stepping down from being CEO a few years ago. And the previous CEO, Bob Chapek, or Bob C, has been replaced. And so pretty controversial news because they brought in Bob C, you know, as like the safety blanket after Bob Iger. But now, you know, there's a lot of different things happening at Disney. Performance has been a bit down. The market's obviously a bit down. They've brought Bob back in as a wartime CEO, I guess.
Yeah, so I think there's some things to unpack in there. Bob Iger is seen as being, you know, one of the United States' most accomplished, best CEOs. He led Disney from, I think, 2005 to 2020. In that time, their stock price was like 500% increase, really, really foundational to their growth and success. And in particular, you know, what he's known for are some real key acquisitions within Disney. So that's Pixar, that's 20th Century Studios. And I think a good segue into our discussion in this week's episode, Albert, is comparing him to Chapek. Chapek was really coming from the theme park segment of Disney, whereas Bob Iger is seen as very much so content friendly. Like, he's in deep with all the Hollywood stars. He has all these major acquisitions really focused on streaming, on content creation, etc. And if you're thinking about, well, what's the thesis, the bull case for Disney into the future, I think you and I are pretty aligned. It's not theme parks, it's content.
For sure. I think, Bob, it's so timely that we're doing this given everything that's happened with Disney. I think that before we, you know, start our deep dive, I also want to throw in that, like, Bob Iger was in conversations to acquire Twitter back in the day. Around, like, 2015, 2016, they were kind of in deep conversations to acquire Twitter. And now, obviously, Elon Musk has acquired Twitter. And there's, you know, been numerous plays. But, you know, there is a world where we are talking about this podcast and talking about a Twitter acquisition by Disney. So it's kind of a funny thing to think about.
It is. But so let's get into the weeds, Albert. If we just sort of take a step back and look at Disney as a business, they have essentially two main verticals. One is their digital media arm and the other is their parks and recreational facilities. I think if we want to just do a quick cliff notes on how parks are doing, doing really well compared to COVID, obviously, you know, really low baseline, no one coming through the doors. Now that's really, really picked up. One of the interesting things to note is that they're kind of price gouging all of the people coming through their gates, where they've got this new kind of structure where you obviously pay for a ticket and ticket prices have gone up. And then once you're through the gate and you actually want to get onto some rides and, you know, skip lines that might be hours and hours long, you have to pay again. So I think it's just an interesting footnote because Disney is trying to boost their revenues, trying to get positive in terms of cash flow, et cetera. And so one thing that they're doing on the park side of things is probably going to be replicated to some extent on the streaming and media side of the business, as there are discussions about potentially raising subscription prices, et cetera. But I think we can park parks there, Albert, and let's get into streaming. What do you want to hit first with this, you know, the main part of the Disney franchise?
Look, there's so many things we can dive in on Disney and talk about their you know, D2C business. You can talk about their licensing business. You can talk about their, like, what they call linear networks, which is, you know, their cable and broadcasting business. I think, to me, the most interesting part of the business is obviously streaming. And so I think it's worth a pretty long conversation on that. I'm sure everyone's, you know, relatively familiar with, like, the Disney franchise and the Disney IP, but let's kind of just hit it right from the top. The Walt Disney Company, very historic American business. They started with, you know, the iconic Mickey Mouse and associated cartoons and cartoon films. They've then started to pump out, you know, more content historically around the Mickey Mouse kind of, you know, universe, for lack of a better word, or if we want to use kind of the terminology that Disney like to use now, things like, you know, Donald Duck, Goofy, etc. And then they started to make kind of more motion picture films. If you want to fast forward to where Disney is now, they've kind of built out this ginormous intellectual property library, acquiring, you know, Pixar a number of years ago. And you can read about the, like, Bob Iger Pixar acquisition and, you know, how he went to Steve Jobs and then negotiated through that. And then they've obviously also acquired Star Wars from Lucasfilms, Marvel and the associated kind of Marvel IP. I think they own about 7,000 Marvel superheroes, which is, like, an incredible amount.
Not Spider-Man, though.
That's true, not Spider-Man. That potentially might return to them soon. And so I think they all own almost all Marvel superheroes. And then they've obviously got kind of a much broader base of streaming. They own ESPN. They own a bunch of different cable networks, licensing networks. They also own, like, Hotstar. They have a partnership with Hulu, which they kind of own majority rights of. And then they've also kind of owned and divested from, you know, different streaming services as well. So they recently sold Endemol Shine, which is a company that, you know, was Australian based and owned things like MasterChef. So Disney's got this, like, ginormous content library and IP, which they've then leveraged historically in a number of different ways. The first is, you know, to create animated films and then launching those films in cinemas or through their distribution partners. And Bob really came in and transformed the business into a streaming business. And then I'll stop there, Dan, and then we can talk about streaming. But obviously, there was a lot to unpack there.
No, but I think it's good to just sort of have that overlay as we kind of dive into what Disney is. You know, they are subscription-based with their Disney Plus service. They have over 33,000 episodes in their library, 1,800 movies. You know, when I was reading those numbers, immediately it gave me flashbacks to our deep dive into Sony and just thinking about, like, the amount of content they have, the amount of IP they have is actually staggering. And it would take, like, years for someone to sit down and actually just sort of watch everything that they're producing. So that's huge. I think what I really want to highlight to the listeners, though, is it's not all just, like, streaming. It's all the same sort of stuff. There is, I guess, what would you call categorization within that? You mentioned you got Disney Plus, which I think is a bit more general entertainment. You've then also got ESPN, which is obviously sports. Hulu is a little bit more, I guess, premium content of sorts. And then you've got sort of the other tiles as well, National Geographic, et cetera. Marvel, obviously big with superhero films. So really, like, there's certain segments there. And Albert, what I really want to sort of dive into is there's tons of streamers. You know, there's Netflix, there's Amazon Video, there's Apple TV. If I just lob an easy one over the plate to you, why is Disney positioned to succeed above those other streamers?
Yeah, I think because, I mean, the clear answer is because Disney owns the IP and they've got IP that really resonates with people. So I think streaming, you know, historically started at user-generated content. It's like YouTube is the classic one, which is like, anyone can create content and then YouTube will distribute it. So, and that kind of thesis held, obviously, for like a decade. But now there's so much content. Literally everyone can create content. And because there's so much content, Bob Iger kind of had this thesis that we're in a world where there's heaps of content, the people who have the best quality content, not the most content, but the best quality content, will be the most successful. And so they're really invested to build really, really great content and acquire great content. So to answer your question, Dan, I think, you know, easy question to hit back is because they're just going to have the best content. It's the zeitgeist of content. And because of that, they're going to continue winning.
Yeah, I don't know if that's true. And we were really having this argy-bargy before we started recording. And then we said, we're leaving too much on the table. Let's turn the mics on. You know, this idea of best content being correlated with this library of IP, I think that's perhaps where, like, it's not passing the sniff test for me. Like, if honestly, I think Mickey Mouse is kind of irrelevant. And maybe this is just because I've aged out of the bracket. Totally could be true. Got my blinders on.
Okay, Mickey Mouse has not been in a motion picture film for decades. So I don't disagree with that at all.
That's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying. And so then when we're talking about best content, and we were having this argument about Mr. Beast, to me, if you're talking about zeitgeist, Mr. Beast is the zeitgeist of a generation. He's ubiquitous. He's everywhere. He's launching fast food burger chains in America, where he's going to a mall, and literally at the opening of his burger store, he's breaking the Guinness World Record for most burgers sold in a day by like 2.5 times. Like, he is just absolutely killing it. And where this all converges, because I know what your answer is going to be based on our discussion, different ends of the spectrum. People go to Disney for movies and certain types of content. People go to YouTube for Mr. Beast and shorter form content. I get that. But ultimately, they're all fighting for our eyeballs. I've only got X amount of hours in a day I can give my eyeballs over to them. And so, yes, I am choosing between Mr. Beast and Disney or and Netflix, TikTok, Instagram. It's all just a fight for attention. And I don't know if Bob Iger's better quality wins out actually works when you're talking about that entire spectrum. I think it works head to head. If you're talking movie versus movie, TV show against TV show, I don't know if it works when we're talking about like just straight content v content.
Yeah. I mean, there's lots of ways, but if you look at, I mean, they're completely different ends of the spectrum. And again, like Disney is all about what is going to be the like zeitgeist of the moment in terms of film and in terms of entertainment. And you can see that with how their business has performed in terms of things they've launched. Like Pixar movies continue to do incredibly well. They had this amazing build-up with, you know, Marvel starting from like 2005 or 2007 when they launched their first Marvel film to, you know, 2020 and 2019 where Avengers Endgame became like the second most highest grossing film of all time, like 2.8 billion. If you look at the list, they've obviously got a bunch of films in the top highest grossing films list. I don't think Mr. Beast is making $2.8 billion from like 3.5 or 2.5 hours of content aggregated. But again, that's not where I think the power of Disney is, because they combine high quality content with their own distribution. And I think that's where creators who rely on these other platforms like Instagram or YouTube as a way to like win eyeballs are going to lose out, because their distribution channel is not something that they own. So they're competing with every other creator on that distribution channel, whereas Disney own their distribution and they can basically control who looks at which pieces of content. And so when I think about content and attention, I agree that Mr. Beast has done and will probably continue to do incredibly well, but they are completely different ends of the spectrum. And I also kind of put to you, Dan, that like while Mr. Beast is really, really, really great, like he caters for a very specific culture of the internet, right? Disney has a subscriber base globally, around the world, across multiple age brackets. Like you could be a 45-year-old or a 50-year-old, 60-year-old, and watch a Disney film. And I know that because, like, my dad will go watch, you know, a Marvel film or, like, you know, his friends or whatever. Or you can be a 10-year-old and watch a Disney film. You can't be a 60-year-old, or there's very few 60-year-olds, I imagine, who are watching, you know, 25-year-old Mr. Beast.
I want to kind of pivot the conversation out because I think this is a really good topic to pick up. We're kind of talking about reach at the moment. And in some ways, Mr. Beast, Disney have got equivalent reach. I think, as you point out, Disney, much broader spectrum across different countries, across different demographics. But and I'll put my cards on the table. I think Disney is a fantastic business. But what I'm trying to underscore is, like, there's big challenges. And I think that's not surprising, because if you change your CEO, it's because there are big challenges that you don't think this guy or this woman is handling properly, and that's why you bring someone else in. And the big challenge I see coming down for Disney, which isn't the case for Mr. Beast or some of these other platforms, is, as you say, they own their distribution network, Albert, which is great, but it also costs a ton of money. And when you're talking about we're heading into this sort of recessionary environment, it's now actually like a really big challenge. How do you price your product so that people are going to pay for it, and it's going to justify the big budgets you're putting into your Marvel films? You know, the cost for Mr. Beast to make his videos is negligible compared to the cost that they're putting in to produce. And obviously now you go into the proportions and the multiples they're making, and maybe it evens out, maybe it doesn't. But you know, just an example of the environment we're moving into, and this is sort of relevant to listeners anywhere, but, you know, we're moving in an environment where lots of people with mortgages, they're in like fixed rates where they're maybe at something like, you know, 1.25% or something. In the next 2 years in Australia, it's predicted that about 40% of those mortgages are going to flip over into variable rates, which is going to then increase their potential mortgages by like 40%. If now your like free cash flow that you've had is now constrained by extra mortgage repayments, and this is, you know, a huge chunk of Australians, and, you know, put this to wherever you're living in the world, you're not going to then spend on having 5 subscription packages. I know this is kind of a long-winded point, but the point I'm getting to, Albert, is people are going to have less disposable income. That's a fact over the next couple of years. It's going to be really hard then to compete saying that your product, you should subscribe to Disney Plus compared to a Netflix, Prime Video, Stan, you know, whatever. Like, that's what I'm concerned about for Disney, and I think it's a legitimate challenge for them.
I completely disagree. In the last 12 months, interest rates have risen in the US. But you know what else has also risen? The number of subscribers. So if you're trying to project out forward to say, like, a change in interest rates will then lead to a decline in subscribers, like, that hasn't shown true in the past 12 months, even though the US Fed's been hiking rates, you know, the fastest it's ever had, as inflation increases as it's ever had. And I think the other thing to note is, like, there are little pricing levers that you can play with in order to generate like a strong, sticky return for customers. So like part of that is like, you know, what Netflix is doing and what Hulu is doing, which is like ad-enabled streaming. Like, it's much cheaper, but you offset the cost with ads and things like that. And so I actually don't buy your argument that like a change in percentage points of interest rates and then the downstream implications of a subscription service.
Like, well, it's just increased cost of living. And I mean, this is where we can go different jurisdictions.
For sure. But,
like, if you look at Australia in this last quarter, subscriptions have been down 500,000.
For sure. But if you're someone who is feeling mortgage pressure of an extra $100 a month, you're not cutting, you know, your $12 Disney Plus subscription. You're probably trying to cut out like going out an extra night. And if anything, going out, it means you need some entertainment at home. You're going to keep your Disney Plus. So actually, I really struggled to buy that argument, because historically in the past 12 months, the Fed has increased, like the US Fed, and that hasn't had a flow-on impact on the domestic customers in the US. And internationally, inflation's obviously up and rates are also up. And that also hasn't had a change in the past 12 months for their subscribers. This is like October to October. And so if you're trying to project that forward, the data doesn't show that. And I actually don't believe consumer like habits are going to change that either.
It's funny because your background is showing, Albert. I was looking into some research by Deloitte, and I think you know Peter Corbin, don't you?
I do, yes. Peter Corbin, yes.
Yeah. So I mean, exactly that. They put out some stats that in terms of cost cutting, when they ask consumers, 9% put digital media subscriptions at the top of their list of things they would cut. But that's well behind 30% who would cut eating out, 27% would cut alcohol and tobacco, and 12% they would cut back on groceries. So you're right, it's lower on the pecking order of things people would start reducing due to cost pressures. But one of those sort of consumer stats that I wanted to pick your brain on, Albert, fellow sort of Deloitte alumni, one of the things they've got is 2021, average number of digital subscriptions per household, 2.3. 2022, it's now up to 3.1. I'm curious, because I know you've got lots of subscriptions, Albert. What do you think the upper limit is of sort of subscriptions per household? Do you think it's going to go flying past three, or do you think there's sort of a natural limit where people are going to cap out?
Oh, yeah, I think it's hard to really tell, because obviously different subscription services, you know, have very, you know, different sets of content they put on. But I'm going to say three is probably where it caps out. Just like at a high level, which is like probably like a kid's, I'm just thinking of like a classic, you know, household. You probably have like a kids focused subscription service, and I'm going to say Disney, and then you're going to have something like Netflix, because everyone has Netflix and they've obviously got like a really, really high penetration rate. And then you might have something specific to that individual, whether it be like sports or Hey You for reality, or something. Or YouTube Plus, like, do you count YouTube Plus as a subscription service? Do you count Spotify? Like, well, what do you mean by like a subscription service? So,
well, I mean, as an example, one of the consumer sort of survey markets did, the top three are Netflix, Prime Video, and Disney in Australia. So if the thesis holds that households will have up to three, then Disney being that top three is pretty good. And after that, you know, you have your Stan, Binge, KO, Paramount, Apple TV, etc. Albert, we've deep dived into the streaming part of things. Do you want to pivot to another part of streaming, or do we want to pick up next?
Look, I think just before we kind of move off this point, I think it also just comes down to like exclusive rights. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know whether, you know, people know this, but when Disney came out and announced this acquisition of this company called BAMTech, which is like their distribution streaming platform, at the same time, they also announced... And this is a really great earnings call to watch, but like they also announced that they were taking all their content off Netflix. And so because there's very little crossover, almost no crossover now between Disney content and other like streaming services, people are almost always going to default to owning Disney, because you might have crossover across like Amazon and Netflix. You might have crossover between like Stan, which is a content provider, or like Paramount, you know, which is, you know, obviously run by CBS. So because there's very limited crossover, there's incentives for a customer, like a subscriber, to keep a Disney subscription.
All right, well, there's sort of two things I want to hit, and I'm going to throw them both to you, one after the other. So, you know, first is to do with the, I guess, losses of the streaming segment, and the other is to do with ESPN, which I think is a really interesting topic to dive into. On the first point, you know, one of the main reasons Chapek's out and Iger's in is in the Q4 reporting for Disney, which just came in, you know, 2 weeks ago, Disney lost $1.5 billion on its streaming service. So what's the fix to that?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of things here. And, you know, I'm looking at their costs now, but I haven't dived into, you know, the details of where the losses are. I think the first challenge is content costs a lot of money, right? Content's like an upfront investment, and you and I know this more than anyone, but you upfront, and then because you've got kind of upfront costs, you front load that, but then that content like powers into perpetuity, or ideally into perpetuity, in that, you know, someone's going to watch something that you've made. You know, people are still watching, you know, Star Wars films, people are still watching Avengers films and things like that. So that's like obviously the biggest outlay, is that in order to continue producing and building your content library, you need to really, really push through like high volumes of content.
Yeah, when it's not just high volumes of content, you might be paying to acquire that content. You know, I've seen one of the big reasons for Amazon's, how would you say, I guess, increase in subscribers is they've invested in purchasing, you know, the Lord of the Rings rights, so they can have that franchise. There's obviously a lot of advertising that comes with this, as they're sort of pushing their products over everyone else's. So, you know, but to me, Albert, the reason why this is a concern, and I feel like I'm taking the negative route just to be a bit more of a foil for you, Albert. But, you know, what I'm seeing there is those are things I don't see going away. Like, I don't see the need to compete with other streaming platforms and advertise and pay for advertising. I don't see that going away. I don't see the need to pay to get good quality content going away, albeit Disney, you can say, has got the library, so that's sort of a natural hedge. But, you know, what's going to turn this part of the business profitable at some point?
Well, I mean, there's a few things here. Like, firstly, like, the challenge, and we're just speculating now on costs because they don't break down what's actually driving the cost. In the commentary, it's like, you know, changes in subscribers. It could also be Forex, like foreign exchange, what they also talk about. And so it's hard to really look at, you know, Disney's cost structure without the details. But what we do know is that subscribers are going up, average revenue per subscriber is going up. And so the loss is probably a big change in, you know, how much content they are producing. And it probably makes sense, you know, in the past 12 months, there hasn't been as many lockdowns or almost no lockdowns in the US. And so they've probably started to push out a lot more content and building out their distribution, scaling across different markets and things like that, because now this is the right time to do that. And so, again, like, it's hard to really understand or pick apart the losses within Disney Plus. I think to answer your question, though, is like how you turn into profitability. It's like there's kind of two things, right? Like, if you look at it on like an annualized basis, it's very hard for a company that's constantly pushing like cash outlay to be profitable. But you have to remember that Disney has this ginormous flywheel in the business that enables it to like monetize their IP, not just from, you know, TV shows, movies, but also through like licensing, through theme parks, which, you know, people actually do love and are like a symbol of Americana, all sorts of different things. And so maybe that's a cop-out answer to say it's really hard to say how they're going to be profitable without understanding, you know, what's driving their immediate loss. But when I look at how they're performing from a subscriber base, the fact that they're growing subscribers and increasing average revenue per subscribers, I think it's just about trying to find the right mix of pricing and content investment.
Yeah, I mean, I was trying to find it as you're talking, Albert, but I'm fairly sure there is a part in their Q4 report where it's, you know, it's just a paragraph, but very generally they say, you know, the losses associated with increased advertising costs, cost of production, those sorts of things. So fairly generic and as what you'd expect. But also to my point, I think, you know, what you'd expect, it's kind of part and parcel of the content game. So interesting to see how they address that challenge. And what seems to be coming down the pipe is like an advertising, what would you call it, subscriber option, where, you know, you could subscribe and there's going to be ads on there and then they can produce revenue based on that ad-generated revenue. Where I want to pivot to, Albert, because I'm kind of interested in this, is the sports segment for ESPN. And there's been a lot of talk about what Bob Iger is actually going to do with ESPN. Is he going to sell it off at a time where it might be, you know, potentially attractive to do so at the moment? One of the key dynamics with a sports platform like ESPN is, as we were saying about front-loaded costs, these channels enter into like 10-year-long deals, licensing arrangements, to buy the rights to NBA basketball, NFL football, whatever it might be. So I think the NFL deal is something like $110 billion over 10 years. And the bet you're making as the streaming provider, whoever, is that over the course of that 10 years, you're going to produce more than $110 billion in revenue. And so you're going to come out ahead. It's a big risk, because if you come out wrong on that end of the equation, and a lot of the licensing rights for these sports are just going up and up and up. Albert, if you're Bob Iger, do you keep ESPN or do you think you spin it off at the moment, get that cash and use it for something else in the business?
Oh, it's just a really, really hard decision here. And I think this is like, again, this is like the reverse of the Disney decision. And so the classic case for like any, this is almost like the classic playbook now is like, if you're a content provider, you should own distribution as well. Because if you own distribution, you then control the customer and every touch point with the customer. And so you can see that with Disney, because now they have the content and they own distribution. You can see that with Netflix, because they're trying to do that. They previously had distribution, and now they're investing heavily in content. And you can see each of these platforms, these sporting platforms, trying to do the same thing. So NBA has obviously got League Pass, and they're trying to do the same thing. You know, the NFL's also got, you know, their NFL Pass, you know, F1. Like, all these different sporting leagues are also trying to do exactly the same thing and own their distribution. Because if you own distribution, you're not giving up, you know, margin. But also, you own the touch points of the customer. You can monetize the customer and things like that. And so, this is a really, really difficult question to answer. I think if I was Bob Iger, I probably would want to understand, like, what is specifically that, like, flywheel that you can push someone from ESPN through to the broader Disney flywheel. And if you can't do that at scale, then I don't necessarily think Disney is a natural owner for ESPN.
That's such a intuitive response, Albert. I think it's on point, because one of the issues I see is, what's the best universe for sort of ESPN to sort of live in? And we can already see the trend, and you and I both know this. It's live sports betting and affiliation with gambling. And, you know, you can see now, if you hop onto ESPN's website and you hover over, you know, games, it might show the odds for that game, and you can sort of place a live bet. Live betting's huge in America. It's slowly becoming deregulated. Check out our episode on DraftKings. You know, it's definitely a trend. Is Disney the natural owner for a business which is best growth prospects are through gambling? Probably not. And what seems to be the case, if you look at Iger's history, is he's very much in on family-friendly content. You know, the Lucas films were seen as a bit of like an interesting pickup from him, because it is a little bit more mature content. And so if you had to ask me, if he's looking at ESPN and thinking the best way forward is through affiliations with gambling, DraftKings, whoever it might be, I think he's going to look on that a bit poorly, as you said, Albert, in the broader context of a Disney flywheel, because it just doesn't seem to marry up quite right.
You know, it's hard to say, because, like, Disney owned DraftKings, right? They owned DraftKings because that came with 20th Century Fox. And that was an acquisition that Bob Iger led, right? So it's not, like, unknown to him that he owns an asset that predominantly plays in sports betting. And he also owns other asset in which that sports betting asset, like, is built upon, which is, like, ESPN and the sports. And so, like, while Bob Iger and, like, likes to maintain this, like, family-friendly view of Disney, like, he owns DraftKings, or they own DraftKings, and they own ESPN. And so they are two very adjacent parts of the business. And so I don't necessarily think that is a factor in their decision making. While you know, there's obviously the perception and things like that comes with betting. I don't necessarily think they're thinking about, like, is betting the right thing for us to do? And then how does that work? It's like, within what we're trying to achieve as a company, like, is this touch point the right touch point to have with the customer?
Mm. Well, so Albert, if I put that to you, do you think Disney is going to go a little bit more mature content in terms of, I mean, you can see some of the acquisitions. Marvel, I think, has gone from being in a sort of fun, cute superhero movies into definitely a bit more mature content, darker themes. Like, is this something that you think Disney is kind of changing its branding a little bit away from, you know, the kids Disney Club kind of channel that we grew up on?
Yeah, I mean, like, Disney does have, like, mature content. Like, it's obviously got, you know, Daredevil, which is like a, like, MA or R-rated platform. I think they've also got, obviously, Deadpool and things like that. So I wouldn't say that it's, like, a big part of their push moving forward. I think they're trying to build, like, a zeitgeisty film business. And so you can't necessarily over index in mature or R-rated content for like a better word, because that's not the zeitgeist, right? And so there are things that Disney own that are very, like, mature, you know, the Punisher, and some of them are Marvel and things like that. But in order to have, like, a big generational franchise like Avengers, you have to appeal to the widest audience.
Yeah, for sure. Albert, last points. What do you want to finish up on?
Look, I want to just quickly talk about the Disney acquisition playbook, because they're very interesting and they've obviously done a lot of different things. I think it gives us an insight into how Disney thinks about IP. And so the big ones they've obviously acquired and monetized really well was Pixar, Marvel, and then more recently Lucasfilms. And so they're kind of three really interesting and different acquisitions, but what underpins them is IP. When I say different, like incredibly different companies, different IP, different target demographics. So with Pixar, obviously like very kids-oriented, you know, animated films, they don't have like IP in terms of like historic IP, but they're incredibly good at creating new IP. And so Toy Story, Cars, Monsters Universe, like there's this whole like slate, even like recently, like, you know, they've got Enchanted, Moana, like they've just got this range of like IP that they can constantly like crank out, but it's like a net new IP. And then you've got Marvel, which when they acquired it was like just comic books and superheroes, and it didn't have like the associated like film universe around it, which again, incredibly interesting, because that's just like just a lot of different characters, like as opposed to like one-off intricate storytelling, it's like this like long drawn out winded universe of storytelling. And then you've got Lucasfilm, which like no offense to George Lucas, like when Disney acquired it, it was a dead franchise and it was dead IP. Like it wasn't really like doing anything. They hadn't made a film. There's like the extended universe, but a lot of that was like licensing. And so it is really interesting to see how Disney have their shot selection on IP. They've gone from like IP or like a studio that has this playbook and they can like pump out great IP and content. And they've got like dead content that people really, really love, which was Star Wars. And then they've got this like universe and long tail of IP, which is Marvel. And they've obviously been selective as to which stories they tell from that.
Yeah, I think that's a really good illustration of the range that Disney has. And as you say, the acquisition playbook, because as you say, Star Wars was a dead franchise, not in the sense that like they had absolutely avid, rabid fans who would turn up to these conventions and be all into it. But in terms of like content generation, really, really minimal. And then they picked that up. You could almost say the same for Marvel. You know, they, if we go back to the start of our conversation, Albert, about, you know, Mr. Beast appealing to, you know, a section of the subculture. Totally, Marvel was a subculture. It was comic book conventions, all that sort of thing. And now they take it into the mainstream, made it really, really popular. The question that just prompts for me, Albert, is just like, what's the potential next dead, quote-unquote, IP that's hanging around at the moment that Disney or someone else could pick up, revitalize, and really make shine? You know, I'm sure there's a whole bunch of franchises out there with very avid niche fan bases, which if taken into the mainstream would really, really pop. And it's interesting to think in Disney's own library what they could potentially sort of revive and bring up as well. So I think that's a really good potential growth engine for them in the future.
It's really hard because there is like a content arms race that is happening and everyone plays the arms race differently. So like Netflix does this by just paying actors to write, direct, make movies that they want to make. And so great examples, like they paid $100 million for Red Notice. Red Notice is not a good film. Then they're trying to make it a franchise, but it is incredibly entertaining, but it's a lot of money. And I don't know whether you can create a universe out of Red Notice or The Gray Man or these are kind of Netflix films. Then you've obviously got Amazon and then their push into Lord of the Rings and that acquisition. And then they've got, you know, Disney, which is looking at very high level content libraries for IP. So they're really kind of, there's this content arms race to own IP. I don't know whether Disney is looking right now and scanning the market to see like, which are the stories that we want to acquire and then monetize, or is it time that we kind of take our creative license and just create our own IP? But the challenge with that is it doesn't come with a fan base. And Disney are historically good because they started with a fan base and no customers. Disney are historically good at what are the franchises or the stories with fan bases and no customers? How do we take that and turn them into customers?
This has sparked a really interesting thought in my head, because where I think Disney is a little bit weak, particularly historically, is gaming. And so much on our episodes, Albert, we've talked about how gaming is such a future trend. And if you're thinking about content which can then be weaved into a more mainstream universe, I mean, there's The Witcher, which was obviously a book and then a game, and now has got, I think it's a Netflix series, one of the streaming platforms. If I'm thinking also about League of Legends, which is now, I think, with their own studio, spun off a Netflix series, which is Arcane, really, really successful as well. So, like, gaming studios are interested in utilizing their IP and really leveraging it and sending it off. Interesting to see if Disney will play in that space in the way that, and, you know, this can sort of be our wrapping up points, Albert, but Sony, to me, is far better positioned to take advantage of some of the gaming IP that's out there, given their links, and then they can obviously feed that into their flywheel. So overall, Albert, interested in Disney. I think obviously a very strong business, lots of interesting growth verticals that they can pursue, but also a lot of challenges for me that I'm looking at. How would you sum them up?
Yeah, I mean, your last point about gaming is interesting, and they've historically kind of just licensed their IP to different, you know, gaming studios. Like, you know, you've obviously got like Kingdom Hearts and things like that Disney have played in. So that is an interesting call out. And I think on our Nintendo episode, we kind of speculated and spitballed like what happens if Disney acquired Nintendo for their IP. But I think in closing thoughts, like, I really, really like Disney. I think the thesis that like people want really, really high quality content holds true, and that will hold true kind of in perpetuity. And so, you know, people want stories. People like storytelling, and that's been truth for like hundreds of thousands of years, and that will continue to hold true. And Disney are just the best at storytelling.
Well, you know, after Fresh Capital Media, Albert.
Oh, for sure. And Mr. Beast, right?
All right, Albert, let's finish up there. I think it was a really good episode, a really nice deep dive into some of the levers for Disney and the changes that are happening. Thanks for tuning in, listening to Fresh Capital, a podcast about companies and investing, told in a refreshingly simple way. If you haven't already, rate the podcast. I think we've got the 5-star average rating, Albert, which is pretty mint.
Nice.
But
nice.
Obviously follow if you're not as well as we head into Christmas. It's a nice little gift for us. Every follow and rating really helps us out. Thanks again. See you next week.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Fresh Capital. Every week, we provide a refreshingly simple way to learn how companies operate and how investing works. Just a reminder, all information contained in this podcast is for education and entertainment purposes only. It is not intended as a substitute for professional, financial, legal, or tax advice. The hosts of Fresh Capital are not financial professionals and are not aware of your personal financial circumstances. Any opinions expressed in the show are not recommendations or advice. Please consult a licensed financial professional before you jump in. As always, we look forward to seeing you next week. See ya!